A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
I'm David Knowles, and this is Ukraine, the latest. Today, we bring you the latest news from across Ukraine, report on UK Foreign Secretary David Cameron's visit to the US, and we discuss some updates from Russia, which faces devastating floods and a fuel crisis amid closer cooperation with China.
Bravery takes you through the most unimaginable hardships to finally reward you with victory.
If we give President Zelensky the tools, the Ukrainians will finish the job. Slava Ukraini!
Nobody's going to break us. We're strong. We're Ukrainians.
Every weekday afternoon, we sit down with leading journalists from the Telegraph's London newsroom and our teams reporting on the ground to bring you the latest news and analysis on the war in Ukraine. It's Tuesday, the 9th of April. 2 years and 45 days since the full-scale invasion began. And today, I'm joined by our associate editor Dominic Nichols, US editor Tony Diver, assistant comment editor Francis Dernley, and foreign correspondent James Kilner. I started by asking Dom for the latest updates from Ukraine.
Hi David, hi everybody. So, Kaliningrad, the little exclave, as opposed to an enclave, the exclave between Lithuania and Poland. The Russian missile ship Serpukhov, been docked there for some time, it's on the Baltic Sea, set on fire yesterday. This is coming out of Ukraine's military intelligence, speaking to the Kyiv Independent. So Kaliningrad is that bit of Russia sandwiched between Poland to the south, Lithuania to the north and east. It's got the 50-kilometre-ish Suwalki Gap, the Suwalki Gap named after the nearby town in Poland that separates Kaliningrad from Belarus. It's thought to be a sort of flashpoint if there was ever a conflict with NATO that would need to be taken basically by Russian forces coming out of Belarus to hang on to Kaliningrad. It is very exposed. It is an exclave as an outside of the country rather than an enclave, a separate country within another country. Anyway, so Ukraine's military intelligence agency said the fire had disabled the ship and that its means of communication and automation were completely destroyed. Now, they released a video, you'll find it on social media, said to show, well, it shows a fire on a ship, or, you know, some sort of mechanical facility. They say it's the ship. Why would it not be in the context of what they were putting out? A source from the military intelligence spoke to Kyiv Independent and said that their operatives were behind the fire. First such attack on Russian naval assets in the Baltic Sea. I mean, so many questions about this. How do you do that? How did it happen? How were their operatives responsible? If it's inside the ship, that implies it wasn't hit from outside. If it was outside, is that an aerial drone? Is it a maritime drone? It's a long way to get around to the Baltic Sea. So many, many questions, but it's not been denied by Russia. The Serpukhov, a Bayan 4 missile corvette, about 70-odd metres long, has a variety of different weapon systems. You know, not been denied by Russia. So something very, very odd has happened there in Kaliningrad. It may well be a continuation of the campaign by Ukraine to take the fight outside of their borders. You may remember Dmytro Plechenchuk, spokesperson for Ukraine's Navy, said back in March, at the end of March, said the Russian Navy had withdrawn nearly all of its major ships from ports in occupied Crimea as a result of the attacks in the Black Sea. So seemingly, Ukraine's continuing this naval campaign elsewhere where they can find the ships. Now then, next one. Over the last 24 hours, Russia has attacked 13 of Ukraine's oblasts, the regions that make up the country. causing civilian deaths and injuries across the country. This comes from regional authorities this morning. A Russian missile strike against an industrial facility in Zaporizhia killed 4, injured 8. That comes from Governor Ivan Fedorov. And then a total 13 cities and villages were attacked in Zaporizhia Oblast in total. Separately, a Russian missile attack in Poltava Oblast in the centre of the country, that's just to the west of Kharkiv, that hit a two-storey apartment building. That was related by Interior Minister Ihor Klimenko. One person killed, 12 injured, including 2 children, he reported. And then Russian drones also hit the Dnipro Petrovsk Oblast, right in the city. That area is centred on the city of Dnipro, just south of Poltava. No casualties reported there. And attacks also reported in the following oblasts: Donetsk, Kharkiv, Sumy, Lviv and Kherson. Now, the Ukrainian Air Force said this morning that their air defences had shot down all 20 Shahed-type drones that Russia launched overnight, so probably the 131 and 136 variants. They said at least 4 S-300 missiles had been fired from the occupied parts of Donetsk Oblast. They didn't comment on whether they were shot down, which probably means they were not. A periodic update, just to try and keep in touch with some of the numbers. Ukraine's general staff said this morning that Russia has lost almost 450,000 people since the start of the full-scale invasion. So casualties, don't forget, is a mix of killed, wounded, missing and captured. They also say, Ukraine's general staff say, that Russia has lost over 7,000 tanks since February 22, 13,000 armoured combat vehicles, almost 350 jets, 26 surface naval vessels and 1 submarine, although that was on the surface in the dry dock when it was hit by a Storm Shadow missile. Now, they do put out these numbers occasionally, and we, the Telegraph, have no way of verifying it. However, repeatedly over the last 2 years, whenever such figures come up or are raised with Western officials and on a background brief, a journalist offer a dose of scepticism and ask, look, how much can we trust these figures? And over time, it has settled down, and it seems to be that within-ish, plus or minus 10-15%-ish, the figures seem to be pretty accurate. That is the broad view of the Western officials. So, yeah, I mean, the numbers are very, very high and probably quite accurate from the Ukrainian side. We think Russia massively exaggerate their effect on Ukraine and underplay their casualties. So I don't put any truck at all in Russian figures, but Ukrainian figures have shown themselves to be reasonably accurate over the last couple of years. Won't go any further than that, really. Now then, next one. Ukrainian drones attacked a Russian aviation training center in the city of Borisoglebsk in Russia's Voronezh Oblast. So this is about 200 kilometres northeast of Ukraine. So the Russian telegram channel Astra claimed the aviation centre for flight personnel training was hit by 2 drones. Andrei Yusov, a spokesperson for Ukraine's military intelligence, said the target had been an aircraft factory in the city. Yusov, he was speaking to Radio Free Europe / Radio Liberty this morning, said, "We will not disclose any details, but according to preliminary information, the main production facilities of the enterprise were affected." This continues the steady drumbeat of long-range drone strikes inside Russia. And I'll take a little pause there, David.
Well, thank you very much for that, Dom. Dom, there's one more story I'll ask you just to briefly comment on. Our Brussels correspondent, Joe Barnes, wrote it up for us, and it's about Ukraine's future drones. They're developing drones incorporating AI. What can you tell us about this?
Yes, yeah, I saw this one from Joe, developing artificial intelligence on drones. He says this is part of more the recent £200 million investment by Western countries into the drone production. So UK and Latvia are leading the drone coalition for Ukraine, just as Czech Republic are leading on artillery. And is it Germany doing tanks? Anyway, of the 8 capability coalitions, Britain and Latvia are leading on drones. A recent injection of 200 million into, I think, about 1.2 billion euro pot at the moment. But this 200 million seems to be going on automatic target recognition. So this is basically think about a cruise missile gets to its target by having an internal map of the ground, basically. So it knows what to look for on its way to a target. It then compares that with what it can actually see as it's flying along, and it makes sure it's on track and it goes where it wants to go. Now, the brilliance of that design is that all the computing power and the technology is on board the missile. It's not affected by electronic warfare jamming from the ground. At the moment, the drone technology that we see in Ukraine from both sides is still, it's got to be line of sight to the controller for the smaller drones, and that radio signal can be jammed and it can be disrupted when the drone in its last few seconds, if you like, it dips behind trees or a hill or something or other. So that's why we see so many images of drones flying toward a tank and then at the last couple of seconds it all goes grainy, the picture breaks up. That's the loss of the signal. So to get around that, and that might be the loss of the signal, as I say, because it goes behind trees or buildings and what have you. Or it might be electronic warfare jamming the signal, electronic warfare either on the vehicle itself or from troops nearby. So to get around that, you need something a bit like the cruise missile technology, whereby all the brains are on the aircraft itself and it can think for itself in effect. So if it has an automatic target recognition pack, it knows what a tank looks like. It knows what an armored personnel carrier or a building, which is a big square thing, and to a computer could look like a tank. It knows what a human looks like. So you can tell the drone, or you can tell the automatic target recognition software what to go for. And that means you can then launch drones into a specified area. And then if they lose the signal, they can say, right, well, I've been programmed to go and look for a T-80 tank, so I shall go and find one of those, or I'll fly into the ground and I won't kill civilians. That's the ideal. Now, that takes quite a lot of computing power. There's quite a lot of technical gizmos. Stop me if I'm getting too fancy at the back. A lot of technical gizmos on the drone itself. But as computing power is always increasing and the advances in machine learning and AI now means that drones are on the cusp of being able to have this stuff on board. Now, Katerina Chenarenko, who's Ukraine's deputy defense minister, she's talking about it. She was saying that this system would make Ukrainian drones less susceptible to Russian EW jammers, electronic warfare jammers, and allow pilots to either operate further from the front line or have pre-designated kill boxes they can just launch these drones into to go hunt for themselves. So she said, the great challenge is the last mile of engagement, taking into account that more and more individual electronic warfare systems are available. She said, our drones should be more effective and should be guided towards the target without any operators. It should be based on visual navigation. We call it last mile targeting, homing in according to the image, which is what I've talked about there. I talked about this area on, was it last week's Defence in Depth video? If you go have a look at Telegraph, YouTube, have a look at Defence in Depth, and we talk a little bit about automatic target recognition on drones. It's an area of emerging technology. It's the kind of next step, really, in drone technology. It's fraught with ethical concerns. I mean, what do you do with a drone that can't then see its target if you don't want it to come back to base? How do you make sure it doesn't kill civilians? And obviously, if you don't care about that, then you just say, fly anywhere you like, Mr. Drone. So it is an area where the technology is ahead of the ethical norms, if you like. So it's a controversial area, emerging technology, but it is seemingly the next step, that this technology is now small enough to be able on these micro drones rather than the big thing like Reaper, Pred, all that kind of stuff, and obviously cruise missiles. So an interesting development. Good article there from Joe. So go and have a look at that. It sort of explains it in more detail. Do have a look at Defence in Depth as well. But I think we're going to be talking more and more about automatic target recognition, both on drones and on other bits of technology in the future, David.
Well, thank you very much, Dom Nichols. Let's go to our US editor, Tony Diver. Tony, it's been quite a few days for diplomacy and politics in the US. Lord Cameron, the British Foreign Secretary, is in the US to meet Donald Trump. What can you tell us about this meeting? Why did he go?
Well, morning, David. Yes, this story emerged last night, actually. We knew that Lord Cameron was coming to the US to talk to officials in the Biden administration and Republicans on the Hill here in Washington. What we didn't know is he was planning to make a pit stop on the way and speak to Donald Trump at Mar-a-Lago last night. So that emerged late last night. Lord Cameron flew straight to Florida from the UK, we understand, and he met Donald Trump there. We have a small amount of detail on what was discussed in that meeting, and we can only imagine that it was a slightly uncomfortable meeting, given that since he was Prime Minister, Lord Cameron's been less than flattering about Donald Trump, should we say. He's described him as a xenophobe. He said that he can't believe that he was elected in 2016, that he regrets that, and he's been very critical of Trump's Muslim ban that he put in place when he was president. So there's a bit of bad blood between the two men, it might be said. They're, according to people in the Foreign Office who I spoke to last night, they had a very amiable meeting. I was told that they had a productive chat, which highlighted the breadth and strength of the US-UK relations. And they had a discussion across a range of topics, which included Ukraine, NATO, and the Middle East. And that Lord Cameron was keen to stress to Donald Trump that the UK was putting a lot of money into defence spending, which slightly plays into a bit of a row over the NATO defence spending target, which we can get into in a minute if you want to. But yes, there was this meeting last night in Mar-a-Lago, and David Cameron has now flown up to Washington, where he will be giving a joint press conference with his counterpart, Antony Blinken, at the State Department later today, where they'll presumably be talking a lot about what's going on in Ukraine and stressing the sort of joint commitment between the UK and the US on providing arms and funding, which we talk about all the time. We know lots about that. We know about Joe Biden's spending package and all of the troubles that that's faced in Congress. There might be a little bit more tension in the meetings between David Cameron and some of those Republicans who have been blocking that package, which are also going to happen today, we think. And this isn't the first time that the British government has tried to sway some of those Republicans on the Hill who are sceptical of increasing the Ukraine budget or indeed funding it at all, since that was held up at the back end of last year. We have seen David Cameron get involved in this kind of row before. And in fact, he wrote a piece, a comment piece in The Hill, which is a kind of US political site, in February, in which he said that he was dropping all the diplomatic niceties and he was urging Congress to pass this package. The reason why that may not be such a friendly chat this afternoon is it hasn't gone down especially well with some of those Republicans that the British government is trying to involve itself in what they see as domestic US politics. And in fact, some of them have been not hugely complimentary about David Cameron after the last piece that he wrote. Marjorie Taylor Greene suggested that he was trying to compare Republicans in the US to Nazis and told him that he could kiss her ass. That was the readout from her reaction to that piece. So I think basically it's going to be a pretty tricky trip for the Foreign Secretary. He perhaps has got the worst of it out of the way with that meeting last night, but there's a whole round of meetings later this afternoon, and we'll be seeing how, firstly, the UK tries to, you know, show how much of a great partner it's been to the US, which is a constant theme of these kind of meetings, but also the US trying to make the case that it is still there supporting Ukraine despite those funding holdups that we've seen in Congress over the last few months.
Well, thanks so much, Tony, for taking us through that. I mean, this aid package has been held up for so long now. Do you think that the Brits think that they could succeed? They could change anybody's mind? What's your sense in that? And do we have any idea of what kind of arguments they're using? What are they saying to the Americans? Why do they think that they will succeed?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is $1 million question. Clearly, the British government hopes that they will be able to sway some of these Republicans. My reading on it, to be honest with you, is that this really is a row about domestic US politics. It's not a row about Ukraine necessarily. And since the back end of last year, we've seen this Ukraine funding package, huge billions of dollars of almost $100 billion of Ukraine funding is linked very closely to other domestic concerns, including the US border. And we've talked about this on the podcast before, but there was this the potential of an emerging deal at the beginning of this year where there may be some kind of quid pro quo between Republicans and the White House, i.e. they would vote for more funding for Ukraine in exchange for tougher measures on the border. Since then, we've basically seen that potential compromise collapse, and that's due to the influence of Donald Trump. We've seen Donald Trump is not hugely keen to have new border packages passed before the presidential election because the border has always been something that he's campaigned very strongly on, and it doesn't necessarily help his campaigning chances if Joe Biden is seen to be sorting it out between now and then. So, I mean, that's the kind of key point of this row that I don't really think the British government is going to be able to get anywhere near because the US border is not a concern of the British government and it never will be. Now, the arguments being made we've seen by British ministers, and I met the Defence Secretary when he came over here earlier this year, and he was making similar overtures to the Americans, which is basically to say that if the Western world doesn't put a stop to what Russia is doing in Ukraine, then other countries could be next, that the financial cost of the war in the long run will be much higher if Ukraine isn't the sort of the end of it, and a kind of normative case to be made about protecting liberal democracies and the West being seen to protect its allies against a foreign aggressor. I mean, those are the two main arguments which are made by visiting Brits. We've also seen Liz Truss come over here and make similar arguments and speak to those Republicans. To be honest with you, I don't hold out great hope that despite all of the rows that have been going on here between the Republicans and the Democrats and all of these other previous visits, that Lord Cameron will be able to swoop in and sort it all out this afternoon. But we perhaps will see a bit of movement on what the administration expects from the UK, how the two countries expect to work together, and potentially some warnings about what might happen under a future Republican administration, because as we know, Mr. Trump is much less keen on the NATO alliance as a whole, on countries that don't spend enough on it, and on the war itself. So I think perhaps the best we could hope for in terms of an interesting story to take us on from where we are is a view from either Lord Cameron or the administration on what might happen there. But we'll obviously be following it very closely here. I'm going to the press conference this afternoon, and we'll be updating readers on everything that happens.
Thank you so much, Tony. Is there anything else you'd like to bring up at this point? I mean, maybe zooming out, how is the issue of Ukraine and the Ukraine war being reported in the American press? Do you see it dominating? Is it receding in importance for readers? What do you see there?
No, to be honest with you, the Ukraine war is definitely receding in importance in terms of coverage and what people are talking about. That's been the case since October 7th, and the war in the Middle East took over as the kind of main foreign story here. It is, of course, still being discussed, but it is being discussed in the terms of those domestic political concerns that I mentioned earlier and what might happen on the Hill. And I think early on in the Republican primary race, we saw the war in Ukraine featured quite heavily because it was still a major story over here in terms of how these candidates would deal with it. Since then, I think it really has faded a bit in the public consciousness, and that will be key in the minds of those in the Biden administration who are hoping to drum up some more support for it, both among lawmakers and among the general public. So, yeah, I think we see less and less about this over here, and far less than we do in the UK. And I think that probably reflects the concerns and priorities of American people.
James Kilner, can we come to you? There have been a number of Russian stories that you've been covering over the weekend and into the new week. They're quite important, and they're affecting quite a lot within the country. Where would you like to start?
Hi, David. Yeah, very important news, I think, today coming out of Beijing, where Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, has been meeting. Over the weekend, we reported he was going to go to Beijing and meet Chinese officials to discuss hot topics. It turns out today, and the Kremlin confirmed only 30 minutes ago, he's actually been meeting with the Chinese leader Xi Jinping, and they released a video of them then having a big conversation over in a boardroom setup. And the Kremlin press release alongside this video says that the Russian side, Lavrov, and Xi, the Chinese leader, discuss bolstering Russian Chinese security initiatives in the Asia-Pacific region against and specifically to counter narrow US military political alliances that are anti-Russian and anti-Chinese. I think this is a very, very important story. It essentially highlights the hardening of this Beijing-Moscow access that we've seen grow throughout the two-year war in Ukraine. It's incredibly rare for Xi to meet foreign ministers. So this highlights the importance that he sets on relations with the Kremlin, with Russia. Russian media has been reporting that the last time Lavrov actually met Xi was 6 years ago. So that really highlights the context of this meeting. We also know, and it's now been confirmed again 30 minutes ago, it was floated a week or so ago that Putin was going to go to Beijing. This has now been confirmed. This will be his first overseas meeting since his re-election as Russia's president in the election in the middle of March. So again, the context is really important. To remind your listeners, David, since Europe and the West cut relations with Russia over its invasion of Ukraine in February 22, China has really become Russia's most important economic partner. Last year, the Russian Central Bank said that trade between the two countries had increased by 26%. We know that China is buying a huge amount of Russian oil and gas, and the yuan has become the most traded currency in Russia from a virtually negligible position. The Russian Central Bank has been encouraging Russians to skip Western sanctions, financial sanctions, and do through currency swaps with China through the yuan. So really, really important stuff coming out of Beijing, just confirmed 30 minutes ago by the Kremlin.
Absolutely. Thank you, James. Well, let's stay in Russia. There's a fuel crisis. Tell us about this. And how important is it in your view?
So this is a story that we've been covering quite in some detail in the newspaper, and we discussed on your podcast before. This is Ukrainian drone strikes on refineries are really having a large impact now. So they've hit 15 oil refineries in 10 different regions across Russia, including some of the biggest. And the latest estimates are they've reduced the Russian refinery capacity by 14%. So I'm not 100% sure how this translates into fuel capacity, but a sizable chunk has been knocked out. Reuters reported yesterday, quoting three unnamed officials with knowledge of the scenario, that the Kremlin has now asked Kazakhstan to supply 100,000 tons of fuel, emergency fuel, to replenish its resources in Russia, where prices have been rising. We already know that the Kremlin's already asked Belarus to do the same. Kazakhstan has said that it has denied that it's received an official request for this emergency fuel. And Kazakhstan itself, it has three oil refineries. They are permanently being repaired. They need modernizing. Its own refinery capacity is limited. And it also, like Russia, also has a ban on fuel exports. So I'm not 100% sure how it's going to play out there. Kazakhstan is part of the Eurasian Economic Union, as your listeners will know, which is the Kremlin-led economic bloc, which has been, basically been essential to the Kremlin's skipping Western sanctions. So Russia, again, leaning on former Soviet Kazakhstan to try and prop up its limping economic scenario. One important side story of this, David, is that the US has apparently had a word with Ukraine and said, and asked them to stop this apparent alleged attacks on these Russian oil refineries. It is worried that that Russia will retaliate and crimp Western oil supplies, etc. We know that there's a huge pipeline running from Western Kazakhstan through to the Black Sea. It's called CPC, which supplies 1% of the West oil supplies, and that runs through Russia. So it does have a lot of leverage over that sort of thing. And the US is trying to step in because they're worried that this is going to basically trigger a huge rise in fuel prices around the world. So again, another massive story, huge ramifications from this. What has really been a relatively successful drone bombing campaign by Ukraine on Russian oil refineries.
And there's one more piece of news, James, which I think is important to mention. This fuel crisis, this meeting with Xi Jinping in Beijing. Back at home in Russia, there have been some absolutely catastrophic weather events. What are they, and what impact do you think that will have on the country?
So this is the massive flooding scenario just happening across North Kazakhstan, North and West Kazakhstan, and Siberia, so southern Russia, on the border area with Kazakhstan. The Kazakh president, Kasym Jomart Tokayev, said in an address to the nation on Saturday that these were the worst floods in Kazakhstan for 80 years, really puts the context on this situation. Now, the floods have been caused, global warming has been blamed for the floods. The winter season has been shortened by about 2 or 3 weeks in the mountains. And there's also been heavy rainfall. And this has basically swelled rivers and reservoirs to breaking point. In an area which spans the length of Western Europe, we've seen massive amounts of flooding, towns being evacuated, dams bursting, etc. Mainly in Kazakhstan in the last 10 days. But then on Friday evening, the authorities in a town called Orsk, which is about 10 miles north of Kazakhstan, started to evacuate people there when they said that a dam had failed. The following day, there was this deluge of video showing rescuers nipping between flooded villages, the roofs of houses visible on boats, etc. And only today, again, we've had more warnings across southern Russia in the Oblast of Orenburg and Kordagan, where they're saying that some of the rivers which drain the Siberian steppe and the Ural Mountains have risen by 1 meter in the last 2 hours. And they're again trying to evacuate 1,000 people from their homes. Now, how this plays into your listeners' core interests, which is the war in Ukraine, I think this is another crisis at home, which is going to sow more doubt into minds of ordinary Russians about the competence of the Kremlin. There's already a lot of people calling for Emergencies Minister Sergei Kudenkov to resign. He's the guy who fronts up the Kremlin's emergency response unit, who's been down to Orsk, who's toured the flooded areas, etc. And he's getting the he's getting a lot of flak for apparently giving the evacuation order too late and trying to reassure local residents at the end of last week before the dam failed that everything was going to be fine. And this important thing is here, it also comes a couple of weeks or so after this terror attack in the Crocus City Hall music venue in Moscow, where 145 people died, etc. And we now know that dozens of those people who were killed, I'm not 100% sure, certainly dozens died of smoke inhalation rather than gunshot wounds because the fire exits were locked and blocked. And again, Kudenkov, who fronted up the Kremlin response, again said initially all the fire systems were working fine, blah, blah, blah. Sprinklers were on, the exits were open, etc. This has been shown to be not true. So again, Kremlin competence is being challenged. So I think all these things just pile pressure on the Kremlin.
Well, thank you so much, James. Francis Sternley, can I come to you? I know you have some thoughts and analysis on some of the developments in the US in the past day.
Thanks, David. It's very interesting hearing the mood on the Hill from Tony. As he says, the danger for Lord Cameron is he actually makes it harder for Speaker Mike Johnson, whose team have, after all, said the Republicans now expect to pass the military aid package in the coming weeks, to rally the MAGA wing of his party to support that bill. It could backfire, which is why I imagine Cameron was eager to meet with Trump in an attempt to show that he's not a mouthpiece for the Biden administration. The fact he's over there, of course, speaks to the deep concern among Western capitals of what an American withdrawal or reduction of materiel and personnel in Europe would mean for their defence, hence why they're trying to talk Trump around. Of all the European nations, it's Britain that many argue has the best chance of doing so, given Trump's stated Anglophilia. Given Trump's recent remarks, many believe a full American withdrawal from NATO is unlikely, not least because more countries are beginning to spend the agreed 2% of GDP on defence, as he demanded. So the real concern is what a reduced American involvement in Europe and in Ukraine would mean. I say again, though, that even in the likely best case scenarios as things stand from a Ukrainian perspective, holding the current front line, a Biden victory, etc., it is unlikely that will be enough to deliver decisive successes on the battlefield against a reviving Russian army. There is not the political will among the Democrats in Washington to provide more weapons, even if the Democrats win in November. Therefore, the ongoing debate, as we see today with Cameron urging the military package to go through, is surely secondary to the primary one, namely, to Dom's point, what are we giving weapons to Ukraine to achieve? I think the unspoken objective remains simple as far as many Western capitals are concerned. For Kyiv to hold on to the territory it's retained following the full-scale invasion, enforcing a stalemate until some sort of negotiated settlement can be found. Yet that is predicated on an assumption that the current weapons allowance from Washington and Europe is enough to ensure that. That's a big assumption long term, as the Russians plan bigger offensives and continue to harbour maximalist objectives in the country. It also assumes that Article 5 is watertight, and therefore, however much Russia may have expanded its armed forces and however armed the Baltic states are, it would never actually do anything else beyond Ukraine, that Russia has effectively received a bloody nose and has been humbled. If that is the unspoken objective of Western countries, then I would argue that even if it were successfully achieved, it misunderstands at least two crucial points. The degree to which Russia is capable of major destabilisation, even with the existence of Article 5 in the Balkans and in other grey zones in the European sphere, which, of course, Dom alluded to a moment ago, and the degree to which Russia has been radicalised by this war, making it more bellicose and therefore more dangerous. It also recklessly underestimates the degree to which a Russian victory in Ukraine would humiliate the West following its stated objectives of supporting Ukraine for as long as it takes. Surely something unadvisable in an increasingly febrile global context. It would also, bear repeating, enable the wide-scale persecution of millions of Ukrainian citizens, including children, as illegal under international law. Because be under no illusions, that is exactly what would happen. That is the only way that that country could be subdued. As Edward Gibbon said, resistance, if it cannot avert, will increase the miseries of conquest. And once you permit such egregious behaviour on European soil once again, it changes the moral architecture of the world we inhabit, as I've said before, making previously unacceptable behaviours, supposedly suspended by the collapse of the Soviet Union, permissible once more. The Baltic states are closer to this viewpoint, but they are still losing out to the so-called realists in Washington, London, and Berlin. There is some evidence the ground has shifted in Paris, but again, we have to see deeds, not words, I think. Fundamentally, it is a question of political will, as it has been ever since the invasion began. I would argue that too many politicians believe the political weather is fixed on the current status quo and therefore remain silent or hesitant without realising that with more courage, many others are likely to support their view of taking more action, whether in the case of weapons deliveries or in terms of having a serious conversation about what the red line is for the West in Ukraine. Who knows where we might be now? What policy leaps might have been made had there been bolder leadership on this issue earlier? Which is why Macron's remarks were potentially so significant. For the first time, we were beginning to see a viewpoint be articulated about where the Western red line might be in Ukraine. Regrettably, though, that hasn't really been taken up yet. Indeed, some countries have denounced even the vague prospect of boots on the ground in extremis, including Britain and Germany. Perhaps the only way that will change now is if Russia does make more gains deeper into Ukraine, which of course would result in many, many more thousands of lives being lost. So this is a very roundabout way of saying, David, that perhaps we're having the wrong conversation. Instead of focusing on that military aid package, which is important but is not a strategic game changer, we should be returning to the question of what we want Ukraine to achieve in this conflict. Because if it is for them to win the war, then we are not doing enough. It is as simple as that. Therefore, the West is, in essence, distracting itself via the convenient excuse of obsessing over American aid, which changes little apart from enabling Kyiv to hold on a little longer when time, arguably, is not on its side. A depressing thought, I know, but a humble attempt to try and reframe the terms of the debate.
Coming up, we hear the final thoughts from Dom, Francis and James.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Well, thank you so much, James, Francis, Dom and Tony. Let's move then to our final thoughts. We've lost Tony Diver. He's had to run to cover a story. So Francis or Dom, would you like to go first?
Yeah, thanks, David. So hanging the old drum again. Sorry, I'll go on a little bit about me waiting for the grown-ups in the room. And I said yesterday, I was impressed with Lord Cameron's, well, the joint words between Lord Cameron and Stéphane Séjourné's opposite number in France yesterday, marking the 120th anniversary of the Entente Cordiale between Britain and France. And there does seem to be a bit of a sort of diplomatic, well, it's either a diplomatic push by Britain and France at the moment, or a bit of competition between them to see who can be hardest in their support for Ukraine. I'll take either, quite frankly. But I noticed some interesting comments just over the last 24 hours by the French foreign minister, who said it is no longer in Paris's interest to talk to Russia, because they get mixed results when Paris then puts out the result of those meetings or those conversations, and Russia does the same. The two accounts differ markedly. So Mr. Sejourné was saying it's not in our interest currently to hold discussions with Russian officials because the statements and the summaries issued about them are lies. I mean, very strong word, lies. Don't often hear a diplomat saying that. Now, the context of this is, well, the particular sort of pinprick that set this one off was the result of a phone call last week, apparently, between Sébastien Lecornu, who's France's defence minister, and Sergei Shoigu, which I think France has covered whilst I was away. But, you know, very interesting. They were talking about the Crocus City Hall attack, and France said that they'd offered help, and then Russia sort of turned it around and say, well, better hope that your secret services weren't involved. I mean, absolutely extraordinary. But today, in response to that, if Sejourné is coming out and saying that there are lies and they're not going to talk to Russia anymore, I mean, very, very strong diplomatic language. I wonder if, as I said, this is in concert or maybe some plan ahead of the announcement or the Entente Cordiale celebrations yesterday, or whether or not this is just everyone's had enough of Russian lies, disinformation, and they're all, if not working together, but coming from the same start point and pushing back against this Russian nonsense. But very interesting to see the language coming out of Paris and London at the moment, David.
Thank you very much, Dom Nichols. Francis Sternley, would you like to go next?
Thanks, David. I cited the impressive work of Ed Conway, economics and data editor of Sky News, a week or two ago, as he crunched the numbers into how Russia is continuing to get vital material from Western countries. Over the weekend, he's written a fascinating and important piece on this for the Sunday Times, headlined, "Britain is still making a killing from Putin's war machine." Whilst it is specifically focused on the UK, it remains relevant for many other European countries, such as Germany and France, which is why I reference it here. As he writes, "The figures I extracted from His Majesty's Revenue and Customs Database were among the most startling I've seen in all my years as a data journalist. It wasn't just that they showed our exports to former Soviet states rising to unprecedented levels, up by thousands of percent. More intriguing still were the types of things going there. Hundreds of millions of pounds worth of luxury cars going all of a sudden to Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan and Armenia. Millions of pounds worth of heavy machinery going to Kyrgyzstan. The deeper I dug into the data, the more unsettling it became. I isolated British exports of what are known as common high priority items, a sanctions list of components used in Russian military systems, including many discovered in these missile graveyards. These are the items we know have been used to kill Ukrainian citizens, and it turns out British exports of them to Armenia, Kyrgyzstan, Georgia and Uzbekistan are up by more than 500% since early 2022. This whole murky trade is generating hundreds of millions of pounds for Britain's car makers. Yet the Society of Motor Manufacturers and Traders, Britain's car lobby group, insists there's nothing to see here. Azerbaijan has apparently overtaken Canada and Spain as one of our biggest export partners for cars because this small, stagnant, developing economy is suddenly a superpower. You heard it here first. How long it can maintain this improbable stance is unclear." Conway sadly concludes, "The government says it's doing all it can to stem these flows, but it seems to be fighting a losing battle. Money, it seems, always wins. Then again, it always did. In my book, Material World, I wrote of the astounding incident in 1915 when Britain and Germany did a secret trade. We got Zeiss binoculars in exchange for rubber from Malaya, all the better to kill each other with. Nothing changes." A depressing point on which to end, David, but evidently sanctions are not working, as we've talked about for some time now, whatever European governments might be saying publicly. I'll add a link in the show notes if people want to digest the startling graphs Mr. Conway has put together.
Thank you very much, Dom and Francis. James Kilner, would you like the very final words?
Just to remind readers that there is some other important context with this Russia China access that I was talking about earlier. Bloomberg News at the weekend reported that US officials had told them that they'd seen
an uptick, a sort of sizable uptick. It was, language is vague, but an uptick in Chinese military-linked exports is probably the best way of putting it, to Russia. This is kit which helps Russia build tanks, kit which helps them build artillery shells and rockets, as well as rifle sights and satellite images. The context here is that Russia and China had pledged a no-limits partnership last year, but China had seemed relatively reluctant to send serious amounts of kit to support Russia's war machine. This now seems to have changed, and this is also really important. There does seem to have been a shift in China's attitude towards Russia, possibly because, as these US officials were alluding to, Russia's now on the front foot across the front line, and China wants to back what they see as a winner. So really important context there for the China-Russia axis and for the war in Ukraine. One other small thing that I really want to update your listeners about, David, is this meeting at the end of last week on Friday. Nikol Pashinyan, the Armenian Prime Minister, was in Brussels, where he met Blinken and EU officials, and was promised, this is the important thing here, was promised €290 million by the EU to help Armenian society and businesses reduce their reliance on Russia. As we know, Armenia is trying to shift out of the Kremlin orbit. This cash injection by the EU came as a surprise. We weren't expecting that. And it irritated the Kremlin predictable, which promised Armenia negative consequences if it went ahead and moved towards joining the EU or moved towards military alliances with Europe, etc. So really important sort of side story there, all linked to the war in Ukraine and the sort of growing tension in the South Caucasus, which we've seen escalate because of this war in Ukraine.
Ukraine the Latest is an original podcast from The Telegraph. To stay on top of all of our Ukraine news, analysis and dispatches from the ground, subscribe to The Telegraph. You can get your first 3 months for just £1 at www.telegraph.co.uk/UkraineTheLatest. Or sign up to Dispatches, our world affairs newsletter which brings stories from our award-winning foreign correspondents straight to your inbox. We also have a Ukraine live blog on our website, where you can follow updates as they come in throughout the day, including insights from regular contributors to this podcast. You can listen to this conversation live at 1 p.m. London time each weekday on Twitter Spaces. Follow The Telegraph on Twitter so you don't miss it. To our listeners on YouTube, please note that due to issues beyond our control, there is sometimes a delay between broadcast and upload. So if you want to hear Ukraine the Latest as soon as it is released, do refer to the podcast apps. If you appreciated this podcast, please consider following Ukraine the Latest on your preferred podcast app. And if you have a moment, leave a review, as it helps others find the show. You can also get in touch directly to ask questions or give comments by emailing ukrainepod@telegraph.co.uk. We do read every message. And you can contact us directly on Twitter. You can find our Twitter handles in the description for this episode. As ever, we are especially interested to hear where you are listening from around the world. Ukraine the Latest was produced by Giles Gear, and the executive producers are David Knowles and Louisa Wells.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.